Today's program is brought to you by the Museum of Food and Drink, sparking curiosity about food with exhibits you can eat. For more information, visit mofad.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
You're listening to Feast Meets West, the show where we tell the story behind your favorite Asian dishes. I'm Linda Liu, and on the line is my co-host in Hong Kong, Iris Van Kerkhove.
Hello, everyone.
We are broadcasting from Heritage Radio Network at Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Every episode, Iris and I dig deep on a dish or an aspect of Asian cuisine, and we interview experts on the topic.
But before we get into today's show, Linda and I like to kick off the episode with a question for each other. What's the best thing you ate in the past week?
Yeah. So over the weekend, I tried for the first time this raw Wagyu steak sushi at a restaurant called Sart and Charcoal in Williamsburg. And it was just amazing. It went really well with my martini, and it had some like little crispy garlic flakes on it too. So like, I know this word is like overly used, but just like umami all the way.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
Yeah. What about you, Iris? What did you eat?
So as you know, I don't eat out properly much, but I do unfortunately have a lot of crappy takeout. Usually sadly prep. On the way to work because like I'm late, but
you're so honest.
I remembered this is kind of an oldie but a goodie, and it's somewhat related to today's topic. But there's a small chain in Hong Kong called K Roll, and it's like a fast food concept that does kimbap.
Mm.
And so I got the bulgogi kimbap, and I forgot about how good it was, and it's much better takeout than like a pret sandwich. So I enjoyed that.
Nice. We'll have to do an episode on that.
Yeah, but getting back to today's topic, we're going to be talking about a type of food that Korean cuisine is probably most internationally known for, and that is Korean barbecue. Korean barbecue is, of course, a method of roasting meat that is popular worldwide, with its most famous dish probably being bulgogi, which is thinly sliced marinated beef sirloin or tenderloin. I think part of that popularity is the whole experience of going to a Korean barbecue restaurant with grills built into the tables and sitting down with your friends to cook it together without actually having to do the work of marinating or prepping the meat yourself.
Yes. I've never seen, like, someone dine solo having Korean barbecue.
No.
Yeah. I think it's always incredibly fun to eat as a group, and you can always order more that way. And we are super excited that we have Judy Ju in the studio today to talk about Korean barbecue with us. For those who aren't familiar with Judy, she's a Korean-American French-trained chef based in London. She is a UK Iron Chef, international restaurateur with her restaurants Jinju in both London and Hong Kong. She's also host of cooking channels, Korean Food Made Simple. She also released her first cookbook last year with the same title, Korean Food Made Simple. Welcome to the show, Judy.
Thank you for having me.
One other fun fact I just learned while chatting with Judy, she was the first person on the Food Network to say foodgasm.
Yeah.
I caught some flack for that.
Yeah, I was judging Next Iron Chef, Super Chefs, and I said my expectation was to have 15 or something, no less than 15 foodgasms while I was judging.
Yeah. Ooh. No, I love it.
Mm-hmm.
So let's start with how you were inspired to become a chef, because you aren't always in the culinary world.
No, I've had a really random route into the kitchen, and I don't know if that's just because I had a personality disorder or what, but I started out as an engineering major, thinking I wanted to go into the sciences, and got to college, was doing it. I was like, God, I am not smart enough to be an engineer. I am not going to make it through. I was like, there's no way I could do this. And I managed to graduate just by the skin of my teeth, and decided I just couldn't do anything that hardcore. And so I went into finance just because back
so
then.
So hardcore.
Well, it's not as hard as, you know, computer science or mechanical engineering, or, you know, it's a bit softer, I guess you could say. And so I went into finance and I worked in fixed income derivatives for 5 years at Morgan Stanley. And then I had another epiphany where I was just like, you know what? I don't think I could do this for the rest of my life just because I don't have a passion for it. Mm-hmm. And in all my free time, I didn't want to, you know, read The Economist or Barron's or all this stuff about, you know, the markets. And, you know, I wasn't fascinated by the markets like some people were. And I just really wanted to read about food and go to new restaurants and read Zagat's and, you know, all the cooking magazines. And so I kind of just quit and told my parents, this is what I'm doing. You can't control me. And this is my life. And went to cooking school here in New York at the FCI, now known as the International Culinary Center. Mm-hmm. And never looked back.
That's amazing.
And here I am. Yeah. I don't know if that's amazing because I kind of downgraded my life in every way possible in terms of the hours and the amount of monetary reward.
Oh, no.
And everything.
Look where you are now. TV show, cookbook.
Yeah.
Restaurants.
It's, yeah. Thank you. It's a lot of hard work, I have to say. And I've been quite lucky, too, I have to say.
Yes.
Had some great people around me and a fantastic team.
That's awesome. So how would you describe, what you grew up eating? Did that have an influence into, like, what you're doing now?
Oh, absolutely. My mom was, because she doesn't cook anymore, she was the greatest cook. And back then, you know, you couldn't buy anything ready-made. Like, she was making kimchi, and we had pots all outside in the backyard, and we had a garden growing.
And where did you guys live?
In New Jersey, in Berkeley Heights, New Jersey is where we lived. And I was born in Summit, New Jersey. And even things like kim, which is like the roasted seaweed, which you can just buy now, like, you had to buy it dried in sheets, but you still had to brush the oil on it and sprinkle it with salt and like fry it. And so we used to get, you know, stacks and stacks and stories of that high and just make it for hours all afternoon. And, you know, picking all the prilly leaves out of the garden, and she'd grow chilies like gochu and dry them, make gochugaru, the chili flakes. And, you know, there was seaweed drying in our garage and, you know, all kinds of
the
things
days
fermenting.
Before the Asian mega supermarket.
Oh, yeah. Well before that. There was like maybe a tiny little kind of crappy Chinese oriental market that was nearby, but there was really nothing else. And we used to get massive packages sent to us from Korea with like some raw ingredients in it, and or dry ingredients rather. And my mom would just, you know, make everything from scratch because she had to. And and my dad, you know, like, he just wanted to eat Korean food all the time because that's how Asian dads are. Yep. And so he really just wanted, you know, just Korean food. So I grew up eating a lot of Korean food. And I think, you know, and I think Iris and Linda, you guys would agree that like most Asians are obsessed with food in general, and particularly in Hong Kong. And so it's culturally, it's just a really food obsessed culture, and the Koreans are no different.
Yeah, that makes sense for sure. And how do you describe your style of cooking?
My style of cooking, I think, is very welcoming and inviting. And I like to say it's the kind of cooking that hugs you back. It's a bit cozy. We have people who come to Jinju every single week or multiple times a week because it's that kind of food that is, there's nothing poncy or, you know, nothing too pretentious about it, which is nice. It's just full of flavor. You know, you can choose to do something like down and dirty, like fried chicken and beer, mm-hmm. or you could choose something, you know, that's a bit more refined, like a bibimbap or like a tuna tartare with a Korean mustard vinaigrette. Something on the healthier side, like a salad, and there really is something for everyone.
Yeah, that's great. Mm. So tell us more about Jinju. How did you first come up with the concept, what it means and what it means to you?
Gosh, it's like a child in these restaurants. So Jinju means pearl. Everyone thinks that I named the restaurant after myself, which I didn't.
Oh,
yeah. No, it's one word and it means pearl. Uh-huh. But and it was really just a democratic process. How my partners and I we just voted, and people like the way it sounds, mm-hmm. and it kind of rolls off the tongue. And you know, pearls are very symbolic and a positive. Kind of got natural, mm-hmm. semi, what do you call it, a stone? I don't know what you call it. And they always have magical powers, yet they're also mysterious. So we like the whole symbolism behind the Jinju pearl. Mm-hmm. And I always wanted to create a cool Korean restaurant because, you know, growing up, and still to some extent to this day, there are some exceptions, but, you know, there are always like really cool Chinese restaurants like here in New York. You know, you've got kind of like Buddha Bar or Budokan, or like, you know, mm-hmm. like that are like Hakkasan also, sure. you know, like China Tang, like very cool, chic Chinese restaurants, and even some of the old school places like Shunli mm-hmm. Palace.
Yeah.
And on the Japanese side, you know, super high end, like the Nobus and the Zumas of the world, mm-hmm. and more so. And, you know, not that Jinju is high end, but like there was never like a cool place where I felt that represented the cool side of Korean culture. And so Jinju is, you know, I would like to say kind of a fun, edgy, funky restaurant concept. And in terms of design, it looks like a New York warehouse meets Korea with traditional Korean elements. We have mm-hmm. a big bar scene. We have a DJ a few nights a week. And, you know, most of my clientele is actually not Korean, mm-hmm. which is something that I also find kind of like one of my missions is really bringing Korean food to the masses. And, you know, Jinju in Hong Kong, we can be a little bit more authentic, a little bit more funky. Whereas like Jinju London, you know, it's hard because the British people didn't really know and don't know what Korean food is, you know. And I had like shocking reviews from some of the top critics comparing me to Thai restaurants.
How could they?
I know, exactly. Like really ignorant and saying that my food was missing lime and fish sauce. I'm like, we don't look at these ingredients, you know. So it's been a real education, and we've tried, you know, being a little bit more aggressive, I guess, with the menu in London, but like people just don't buy it, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit more fusion with, I would like to say, like the greatest hits.
Sure.
You know? So like bibimbap and japchae, yep. Korean fried chicken and mandu, which are the dumplings, and of course barbecue. Mm-hmm. But kind of presented in a very inviting beautiful way.
Yeah.
Presented nicely.
Yeah, that's really interesting mm-hmm. how you have to adapt to such different audiences.
Yeah, you have to localize.
Make it work. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Otherwise, you will be empty. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, you know, a restaurant's a business.
Yeah, and you still want to tell your story. And, mm-hmm. and maybe like 5 years from now, they can get on
the
wagon a
exactly.
little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And so tell us about Korean food made simple.
Korean food made simple. It's on Cooking Channel here in the U.S., Food Network worldwide, Asian Food Channel out in Hong Kong and the rest of Asia. And it's coming up to its third season. And it really kind of, again, kind of continues my ethos of just really wanting to bring Korean food to the masses and globalize, you know, Korean cuisine, because it's one of the, I feel like, sleeping giants of Asia, where, you know, most people can name Chinese dishes and Japanese dishes by name, but still to this day, if you go to certain places and, you know, particularly in Europe, like people have no idea what kimchi is. People mm-hmm. have no idea what japchae is. And people don't know anything about Korean culture. Even all these like massive tech giants like the Samsung, LG and Hyundai and Kia Motors of the world, they think they're Japanese companies.
Mm-hmm.
And, so it's kind of like educating people. And so that's the whole made simple thing. And my whole ethos is that it doesn't have to be 100% authentic. It really doesn't. You know, if I could get people just using gochujang in a few things. And that's kind of my goal. If I can get people, when they do visit a large city, into a Korean restaurant just to try it, that is an achievement for me.
Yeah.
So you'll see a lot of fusion dishes in the book, like things like, you know, like a Korean style Philly cheesesteak, disco fries, as homage to my growing up in New Jersey, to, just like regular steaks that have been marinated in a very traditional Korean way. So it's taking some of the best of Korean flavors and using some Western techniques. And I have an entire chapter on desserts. And, Korea's not really known for their desserts.
Yeah, so most Asian countries aren't.
Yeah, exactly. They kind of suck, actually, in Asia. they're just, like, a bit weird. It's, like, mushrooms and, like, soups and, like, sweet drinks and stuff like that. And
glutinous, so, right?
Yeah.
Different textures.
Yeah, you know, and they just don't translate well to the West, you know. And so what I've done is I've taken some of the fantastic flavors. So, you know, obviously, like citron fruit, green tea, sesame, plums, all of these things, and then fuse them with Western desserts and bread too. I have a bread chapter, which isn't traditional either.
Oh my gosh.
So like kimchi bacon brioche and samjang straws and things like that. Yeah.
That's really fun.
It's fun. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. So switching gears a bit to talk about Korean barbecue.
Yeah.
Judy, what makes Korean barbecue different from other kinds of barbecue?
Well, I think that, first and foremost, which you touched on before, was the style of eating Korean barbecue. It's most famed for being cooked at the table, live, basically. And bulgogi, which you mentioned, literally translates to fire meat. Bul being fire and gogi is meat. And so it's traditionally cooked, you know, very quickly on an open flame right in front of you and then just shoved into your mouth as quickly as possible. So it's very interactive. It's very convivial. And you can also get anything can be thrown on the barbecue. So it can be seafood, you know, vegetables, meat that's been marinated, meat that's not been marinated, all different cuts and kinds of meat. Some of it's spicy, some of it's not, some of it's, you know, just plain. And it's really just like the style of it is it's mostly, for the most part, cut very thinly. Because like in China, we don't have knives on the table. Mm-hmm. Dating back to, knives are considered weapons in Asia, and you wouldn't really have them on the table. So everything has to be, you know, small enough pieces and cut up before so that everything is bite size. But Korea, I would like to also say, is that with the flavorings, I find it's a sweet meat. You know, there's always something sweet, whether it's sugar or a fruit or pear that is added. And that's kind of what gives it that interesting, salty, sweet, really kind of savory and alluring aroma to it.
Yeah, it keeps you eating.
It keeps you eating. And even just the smell of the smoke, like the sweetness of the smoke. And because there is a little bit of sweetness in it, it also gets that amazing deep char and caramelization to it. And so there's like a little bit of like crust to it. And then there's like, you know, soft, juicy, sweet meat, you know, whether or not it's a sirloin or a short rib or tenderloin or, you know, pork belly, etc. It's just delicious.
So what are the most popular styles of meat besides bulgogi?
Bulgogi, obviously kalbi, which is the short ribs, and there's LA style kalbi, which is cut, you know, across with the bone, and there's also the regular, I guess, traditional kalbi, which is kind of very thin, but it's all the meat around the short rib as well. And I love samgyeopsal, which is very thinly cut pork belly also. And my mom actually used to make a really good chicken barbecue. So that was tasty too. I mean, you could barbecue anything. I mean, if you go down to some of the seafood towns, like you're barbecuing on the beach and on these open charcoal grills, and it's, you know, the freshest things like in the shell still. It's fantastic. Yeah. Nice. So the possibilities are endless.
Right. And what is it typically served with?
It's this is another thing that I find is uniquely Korean. So Korean, the style of eating in Korea is different. So I like to say that Korea kind of takes a middle ground between China and Japan, and it's physically in the middle geographically also. So as you know, in China, everything is shared, like big plates on like a lazy season, and everybody kind of shares that. In Japan, you get lots of little plates, but just for yourself, like a bento box. And in Korea, you get lots of little dishes that are all meant for sharing. So it's kind of in between. And that goes with Korean barbecue too. So whenever you eat meat, you don't just eat meat. You eat meat with like a ton of other vegetables and a mm-hmm. ton of other textures and flavors. And Korea was always ruled by the philosopher's class opposed to the warriors, which meant that the food always took on a very holistic point of view. And every meal is supposed to have the five textures, the five colors, and the flavors. And that goes whenever you eat barbecue. And so you take a cold, crispy piece of lettuce, and then you put in a scoop of hot, steamy some rice, and then, you know, a piece of like juicy meat of barbecue, and then top that off with a really tangy pickle or some kimchi, and then maybe some samjang hot sauce, which mm-hmm. is the gochujang and the doenjang mixed together, and wrap it all up like a burrito, and then take a bite. So you're getting all those textures, you know, different temperatures and flavors and colors all in one bite.
Just now, I understand why you're on TV, because the way you describe that just makes my mouth salivate. You know the right words to use.
Well, you got to try it out. Yeah. That's the whole thing. Yeah. So there's a lot of, I guess, biodiversity on the Korean table, the traditional Hanshik table. And I think that's also why, you know, Koreans, as well as the Chinese, it's similar in terms of the backgrounds, but you eat so many vegetables. And, you know, that's why Asia is some of like the longest people, like living people in the world, and a lot of, you know, cancer rates are quite low, is because it's like you never just eat meat.
Right. Yeah. And so in Korea, are there regional variations, or is it pretty much the same concept all around the country?
No, there are definitely regional variations and different cuts. And in certain areas, like you get, you know, more different types of prized species of pigs and pork and you know, beef, et cetera. And some places are known more for their seafood. Some places are spicier than others. And Korea, for a small country, has a lot of regions that have various different styles of cooking. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. Mm-hmm. And so we often associate it with eating out at a restaurant, but in Korea, is this something you would do at home as well?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, my mom used to do it in our garage off a small little grill, because it does, unless you have a vent over your kitchen table, you'll make your entire house smell, you know? Uh-huh. So you can't really do it at the table, but you could do it, obviously, under a hood or something. But, you know, like, beware, though, that, like, whenever I go out for Korean barbecue, like, you smell.
Yeah.
Like your hair smells, your clothes, everything. And so, like, you can't really go out afterwards or just wear something crappy, because everything will go in the laundry or the dry cleaning afterwards.
That's so funny. Yeah. That reminds me of, like, hot pot, like Chinese style hot pot, too. You walk out the restaurant just,
reeking. But it's so worth it. It's so delicious. It's so good. Yeah, and then all the garlic, so then your breath smells too. I'm really selling this now.
Yeah, but it's the funnest, you know, food experiences.
It is,
really.
It is. And you should go in large groups. I think that is probably one of the best things about Korean barbecue, is just the conviviality of it, and it's fun to cook things. And also because, like, you're serving yourself. Like, every bite can be different. You know, you can put some kimchi on this one. You can put some, like, pickled radish on this one. You can put some of the hot sauce on this one, some raw garlic, so... If you have ADD with, like, eating, it's a perfect thing with for you.
Right. You can customize it.
Everything.
To your liking. Amazing. So we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network. We all know and love Chinese takeout dishes like General Tso's chicken and egg rolls, but here's the thing. Even though we call it Chinese food, it's not like the food you'd find in China. What's the story behind this cuisine, and how did it become so popular that you can find a Chinese-American restaurant in nearly every town in the country? The answers may surprise you. Visit the Museum of Food and Drink in Brooklyn and see our newest exhibition, Chow, Making the Chinese-American Restaurant. Chow engages visitors with compelling accounts of how Chinese immigrants overcame racism and created Chinese-American cuisine. Discover the science behind the flavors of your favorite takeout dishes, feast on rotating tastings developed by the country's most talented Chinese-American chefs, and try your hand at writing your own fortune, which will be baked into actual cookies by a 1,500-pound fortune cookie machine. What better way to learn, connect, and eat? You can visit Chow at the Museum of Food and Drink on Fridays through Sundays from noon to 6. Tickets and more information can be found at mofad.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Feast Meets West, and we're talking about Korean barbecue. So, Judy, what is your, like, strongest food memory associated with Korean barbecue?
Oh, the smell of the smoke.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. I remember my mom, when she used to grill in the garage, just the smell alone lures you to the table. You're like, oh, so good. And you want to go down, and then she'd give you a little piece right off the grill. Yeah.
That's, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, smells are so strong when it comes to food memories. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And for our listeners, do you have a suggestion for, like, a simple version of Korean barbecue a la, you know, Korean food made simple?
Well, you could buy my book. Shameless plug.
Love.
But, you know, like, for making the, just, like, the straight up, like, bulgogi or kalbi, you don't really need a lot of esoteric ingredients. Like, everything's in your normal ShopRite or AMP or whatever you might have. You know, you just need, like, soy sauce and some roasted sesame oil and garlic and ginger. I mean, it's all pretty much there, but, you know, there's so many different recipes on the internet. It's just, I would just say, just go for it.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
Right. Don't overthink it.
Don't overthink it. And I think that people get nervous with cooking. And I actually like to say that you can't make mistakes. If it tastes good and if you like it, it's a success.
Yeah.
You know, like screw it. Just experiment, have fun, taste as you go along and see what happens.
That's a good way to think about
it. Yeah.
Do you think Korean barbecue has cemented its place beyond Korean restaurants and communities, like, worldwide at this stage? You know, it's funny. I actually saw Trader Joe's selling, like, pre-marinated Korean barbecue meats.
Yeah.
I mean, what's your thought on that?
I think in big cities, definitely. But, you know, New York is a really special place.
Yeah.
LA is a special place. San Francisco, you know, there are large Korean populations in all of these cities, and Chicago too. You know, what I'm trying to do is even reach, you know, the people in Kansas or Nebraska or Idaho, Wisconsin, you know, people in France, people in Germany, you know, Belgium, who don't even know what Korean food is. And, you know, we get so many people in London who've never had Korean food ever in their entire lives. So I wouldn't say it's cemented yet in the same way that Japanese and Chinese food is truly, truly global. And most people know what sushi is and have heard of it.
Yeah.
You know, most people have heard, you know, some kind of stir-fried Chinese dish or like an egg roll or whatever. Korean food is still on the rise, but it's very much trending. Mm-hmm. So I hope to see more.
Yeah, you're spreading the gospel. There's the show. Keep doing
that. Yeah, trying. Yeah. Waving the Korean flag.
Well, speaking of all your different projects, you know, what's next for you? Do you have even more projects brewing?
Yeah, I mean, restaurant expansions
and
always.
Also, like, how do you manage this?
I know. I'm just a glutton for punishment. But more restaurants probably on upcoming. Got some products coming out, sauce line, also spice mix line, which should be coming out soon. You know, hopefully third season of Korean Food Made Simple, we'll get that online next year. I don't know. I'm probably forgetting something. I'm going to be cooking a Taste of Tennis this August. So I'll be back in New York with that. I love tennis, so that'll be fun. And doing the Nevis Mango Festival in July, if anybody's in the Caribbean.
Wow.
I'll be doing that also, which is fun, with the Four Seasons down there. And then I'll be in Hong Kong visiting Iris in September at Jinju there. Yeah. And I can't remember what else I'm doing.
That's okay. I want to go on this world tour with you.
And Wendy. That's fine. Yeah.
And so when people say Judy Ju, because you're doing so much, I'm just curious, what would you most like to be known for?
I would say, like, most to be known for just kind of going off piste. And going off to the road less traveled, you know. And I'd like to say that I am kind of, I'm trying to break down some barriers, mm-hmm. you know, for Asian American women, Asian American, you know, women in cooking. There are hardly any of us,
yeah.
women restaurateurs, Asian Americans on TV and the media. There are very few of us as well. And, you know, I don't want to be doing this forever. I've got to, you know, somebody's got to take my place. You know what I mean? And whoever does, it'll be slightly easier for them. And same sure. with the next generation and the one after that, you know, and hopefully there'll be more of us. You know, I don't want to be the only Korean American on the food network. You know what I mean? I think there's space to have more diversity and more ethnic faces, and mm-hmm. You know, and that's kind of probably what I find most rewarding. I mean, I remember growing up in this country, and the only face that I saw on TV that I could relate to was Connie Chung, and
yep.
And that just gave me the inkling to be able to dream that it was possible to be on TV. And I got a letter from a mother, I think she was in California, saying that her daughter wanted to dress up as me for Halloween. And she was like 8 or 9 years old, which is really sweet. But that's like I don't mean to be a role model in that sense, but mm-hmm. it's, I kind of get it because I'm one of the few faces that she sees on TV that she can relate to.
Mm-hmm.
And to me that is important and probably one of the most things that I find most rewarding. And, you know, and it's so hard. I mean, being a female in this industry is so hard, and a restaurateur, and, you know, being a minority that doesn't really count
yeah.
half the time, you know, people rather cast an African American or a Hispanic, you know, opposed to an Asian American, like mm-hmm. we're kind of the overlooked minority. And so it's hard, you know. My story of success is really speckled with 1,000 more stories of failure,
mm-hmm.
and you have to get used to failure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's, you know, incredible that you're on this mission, but you're also pursuing your own passion for cooking. And
yeah.
it's kind of nice that there's a duality there.
Yeah, it's tiring though.
It's okay. Yeah. So, well, that's amazing. Keep doing
Thank
what
you.
You're doing, Judy. This is so fun. And that wraps up our show for today.
Thank you so much, both of you guys.
Yeah. So, Judy.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us on the show, Judy.
Thank you.
And for listeners who want to learn more about you, what you do, how should they stay connected with you online?
All my socials, my handle is Judy Ju Chef, and my website, judyju.com, and Jinju, J-I-N-J-U-U, is the name of my restaurant. So if you're ever in London, want to hop the pond, or in Hong Kong, you can visit me there.
Excellent. Thank you for tuning in, everyone. Please go follow Judy online and check out her restaurant, Jinju, the next time you're in London or Hong Kong. We would also like to invite everyone to the Feast Meets West community online as well. You can find us on Facebook by searching Feast Meets West or Feast Meets West Eats on Instagram. Not only will you stay updated on what's coming up next on the show, but we also post content on many other Asian foods that you love. We'll be back next week with another awesome conversation from the world of Asian food.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.